All right, now this hour we come to the somewhat monumental task of dealing with Romans 2:12-15. So I want you to turn there, please. Follow as I read that passage. Monumental because I'm going to do it in one class period, and there's a lot of exegetical material that is the kind of material that takes longer to work through, but we'll do the best we can. We read in Romans 2, and I'll begin with verse 12. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. Then verse 14. For when Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively, by nature, that is to say, the things of the law, these not having the law, are a law to themselves, in that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else even defending them. I'll say something about the context of the passage, first of all, by way of introduction. The general subject of Romans 2:1-16 is the coming judgment of God on men in general. Verse 11 states the rule that in this judgment there will be no partiality. There is no partiality with God, says verse 11. There will be no respect of persons, prosopo leipsia, literally, no taking of a man's face, but in Greek as well as in Latin, from face was the root word for, or the word used for, person. Note that verses 12, 13, and 14 all begin with the word for all who have sinned, for when Gentiles, pardon me, for not the hearers of the law, and verse 14, for when Gentiles. All of them begin with the particle for. This shows that verses 12 through 15 are intended to support or prove the assertion of verse 11. They're all elaborating upon the fact that there's no partiality with God, no respect of persons. Verse 12 supports the assertion that there's no partiality with God by the fact that God deals with men according to the law they possess. There's no partiality with God, for all who have sinned without the law will perish without the law. All who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. You see, no partiality. God is strict and he's fair. He judges men according to the law they possess. As will be shown subsequently, verses 14 and 15 are immediately connected with verse 12a. The statement that those who sin without the law perish without the law is a simple assertion, but it raises several pressing questions. The questions raised are these: how can men sin, let alone perish, without the law? Verses 14 and 15 are intended to answer those very questions. But now, I've already assumed that in saying verse 12a is connected with verses 14 and 15, something about the structure of the passage, and now we need to come to deal with that. Now, the passage in view here is verses 12 through 16. Now, the structure of these verses may seem difficult at first glance, but there are two considerations which simplify it and show its interesting and logical character. First of all, I want to say that verse 16 connects directly with verse 12. Verse 16 says, on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. Now, I'm saying that verse 16 connects directly with verse 12, and that assumes what the first sentence says there, that verses 13 to 15 are parenthetical. In other words, they break up the flow of thought between verse 16 and verse 12. And this is shown by the fact that verse 16 does not connect naturally or easily with verse 15. Just read verses 15 and 16. In that they show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness, and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them, on the day when, according to my gospel, God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. Now, Paul asserting that the Gentiles' consciences accuse or defend them in the day of judgment. Now, that certainly would be truth, but the problem is that that doesn't seem to be the connection. For one thing, verse 15 is in the present tense, whereas verse 16 is future tense. Now, because the time period of verse 15 is the present, well, verse 16 begins with the words in the day, literally, it's the Greek preposition n, by which it designates the future day of judgment. Now, this has led commentators to resort to several unnatural and awkward ways of making a direct connection between verse 16 and verse 15. Sometimes they've explained the phrase in the day, en hemera, as until the day. That's the way Calvin translates it. So he says that their thoughts accuse or defend them until the day when God will judge the secrets of men. Or others have interpreted to mean in connection with the day. Your consciences accuse or defend them in connection with the day of judgment. That's how Lemsky deals with the Greek particle or preposition en. These understandings of this phrase are unusual, unnatural, and in fact unnecessary. On the other hand, the connection with verse 12 is natural and straightforward. Just read it that way. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law in the day when God will judge the secrets of men through Christ Jesus. See how natural that connection is? Now, the connection of verse 16 with verse 12 gives a natural and straightforward meaning. And the further support of this connection is the fact that verses 13 through 15 explain verse 12. This fits the thesis that they are parenthetical in character. So first of all, I want you to have noted that verse 16 connects directly with verse 12, and that assumes that verses 13 to 15 are parenthetical in character. But now, I want to comment further upon that parenthetical character in B under the structure of the passage. Here I said the verses 12 to 15 have an ABBA or chiastic structure. Now, what is an ABBA or chiastic structure? Well, the word chiasmus or chiastic is derived from the Greek letter chi. Chi, shaped like an X. And it's a very high K sound. It's the word in Christos. Chi. Now, the word chiasmus, which describes the peculiar kind of structure we have here, is derived from it because it gives a structure that looks like a chi. Verse 12a states a truth, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. And then verse 12b states a truth, a contrasting truth, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. See, verse 12a has to do with those who sin without the law, verse 12b, with those who sin under the law. Now, you see, what happens is that verse 13 then goes on to elaborate on the second half of verse 12, for not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. But then verses 14 and 15 come back to verse 12a. For when Gentiles, now he goes back to those who sin without the law, do the things that are of the law, etc. So you see that there's an A, B, B, A pattern. There's an A that deals with the Gentiles. There's the B that deals with the Jews. Then there's the second B, which explains what he said about the Jews. And then there's another A that explains what he said at the beginning about the Gentiles. A, B, B, A. Or the chiastic structure, which is A, B, B, A. So that verse 12a is an A section. It says those without the law perish. Verse 12b is a B section. Those under the law perish. Verse 13 is a B section. Verse 12b is explained and justified. And then verses 14 and 15 are an A section. They go back and explain verse 12a. You'll note that the subject of the A sections are the same and that the subject of the B sections are the same. Verse 12a and verses 14 and 15 deal with those without law. Verse 12b and verse 13 deal with those with law. Now, this is, by the way, a fairly common structure in at least Paul's writings, the ABBA pattern. And the whole A, and there's another pattern, the ABA pattern, that's also quite common in the scriptures, but I won't comment on that. But anyway, sometimes it's helpful to remember this in terms of sorting out the structures and meanings of passages. Then, how verse 14 connects naturally with verse 12a. For all who have sinned without law will perish without law, for when Gentiles who do not have the law, etc. We are interested in verse 12a, 14 and 15, because those sections deal with those without special revelation and how they know the law. So we're interested in verses 12a, 14 and 15, because those sections deal with those without special revelation and how they know the law. They take us back to the epistemological question. All right? Now that brings me to the theme of the passage. The theme is how God can be just in sending to hell those who never had the law. And by the law here, Paul means special revelation. Paul, in solving this problem, is going to speak of the knowledge which makes it right to punish those without the law. Now, it is this knowledge that is the precise point that we're interested in our study of apologetics and epistemology. We are therefore not taking Paul out of context. We're not asking the wrong question of this passage. It's exactly the question he's dealing with. And now the outline of the passage. We're going to deal with the fact stated, the objection assumed, and then the answer elaborated. The fact stated in verse 12, the objection assumed, no scripture because it is assumed, although I think we can see that it is, and then the answer is elaborated in verses 14 and 15. Right? Now, let's go to the fact stated first of all. And that's in verse 12a. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. That's a fact, it's a declaration, it's an assertion, it's a statement. The fact stated. First of all, I want to say something about the interpretation of the clause. Here I simply want to answer the question, what does the text mean? First of all, I want to deal with the meaning of anomos, which is the Greek word for without law. What does Paul mean here, that someone is without law? Well, the normal meaning of this word is lawless, or lawlessness in the sense of sinful or sinfulness, the way it's used in Romans 4:7, when it says, blessed are those whose lawless deeds have been forgiven. In Romans 6:19, again speaks of lawlessness. Now, this is obviously not the meaning that we are to attribute to the word anomos here. Here, without law means to be outside the circle of special revelation. And the parallel passage is 1 Corinthians 9:21. There Paul says, to those who are without law, as without law, though not being without law of God, but under the law of Christ. Now Paul can't possibly mean that he became sinful to those who are sinful, because that would have been unethical and immoral. What he's saying is that as to those who are without the blessing of special revelation, to those who are without the covenant God has made with Israel, he became like them. So here, without law means to be outside the circle of special revelation. Murray says, the contrast is therefore between those who are outside the pale of special revelation and those who were within. In other words, there's a contrast substantially between Gentiles and Jews. But then we have the character of the judgment. We've seen the meaning of without law, and all you have to deal with the character of the judgment. Now, the judgment in view, in both halves of verse 12, it's important to note, refers only to a judgment involving punishment. All who have sinned without the law will perish. All who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. You'll notice in proof of this, fact that it is the judgment of condemnation that's in view. Of course, it's possible that we could speak of all men going to judgment and some being acquitted and some not. But when we speak of judgment in this passage, it's not that we're talking about. We're talking about the judgment of condemnation. And in proof of this, first I want you to note the parallel between perish and be judged. There's obviously parallelism between verses 12a and verse 12b. And what is perish in verse 12a is judged in verse 12b. And note a second that the word sinned is repeated twice. Those who sinned without the law, those who sinned under the law. This is judgment only of those who are, as to the summary of their lives, sinners. See, Paul summarizes their entire lives when he says they sinned. And he's speaking of the standpoint of the day of judgment. The result of this judgment, therefore, can only be condemnation and punishment. Paul here, in this context, is not speaking of judgment generically. He's speaking of the judgment of condemnation, and that's a crucial thing to remember. But now I want you to deal with it. I want to deal with the meaning of hamartone, the word sinned. Now the tense of this verb is the aorist past tense, and that means two things. The standpoint of the verse is the day of judgment. It is only from the viewpoint of the judgment that the lives of all sinners may be viewed as already passed. But secondly, the entirety of the conduct of the persons is summed up in one word. Lenski says, the errors sum up the whole course of works. He isn't trying to be detailed and atomistic in the way he looks at their life. What was the character of the Gentiles' life? As to the character of their whole life, he says they sinned. What was the character of the Jews' life he's thinking of? As to the character of their whole life, they sinned. So the errors sum up the whole course of works. Not one act, but a whole course of life is in view. And the whole course of life is described as they sinned. I don't think so. I think he, although there would be some propriety in referring to that here, what he's talking about is Jews and Gentiles in the plural, so I don't think it would be a direct reference to that anyway. Now, the fourth thing I want you to notice by way of the interpretation of the clause is the emphasis on strict justice. Note the emphasis on the exact justice or the precise correspondence or similarity of God's judgment to man's sin. And there's correspondence at two points. First, as to the manner of their perishing, we are told they sinned without law. They also, the word is kai hostoi, they also perish without law. The word hostos, hostoi, means such as. They are such as perish, but such as their quality, in other words. They also perish without law. Secondly, as to the identity of those perishing, all who sin, all who perish without the law, that is to say, every last one of them, not one more, not one less, who sinned, also perish. So there's an emphasis here in verse 12 on exact or strict justice. That's also an emphasis here. Well, now, what do we get as to doctrine from this clause? We see the interpretation of it. Well, a number of things we have to say about it, and very important things in our day. First, we learn that those without special revelation can and do sin. As Murray says, specially revealed law is not the precondition of sin. Now, that may sound very simple, but it's very profound, isn't it? They sinned without law. Therefore, special revelation isn't the condition of sin. The second one, those without special revelation not only sin, as a result they perish. So says the Apostle Paul. It is not merely that they're worthy of perishing. Notice, he says they actually or really perish. Notice that one does not need to hear the gospel to sin and perish. Plain? You bet you explain. People sin and perish without ever hearing the gospel, without special revelation. Men do sin and actually perish who have never heard the gospel. Now that has several important implications. First, hearing the gospel is therefore no one's right. God has a perfect warrant to send people to hell without giving them the gospel. Second, it is sometimes said that man's only sin is unbelief or failure to believe the gospel. It is said it's not the sin question, but the fun question. This saying is false. Men do not go to hell only for rejecting Christ. People who never heard of Christ go to hell. But there's a third implication of this. The implication of this verse seems to be that all those who live and die without the special revelation of the gospel perish in their sins. All of them. Now, we've already said it is clear that at least some of them do. Those who sin without the law will perish without the law. It's possible to sin and perish without the gospel and without special revelation. But now, I'm going to take it a step further than what's actually explicitly stated in this verse. The implication of this verse seems to be that all those who live and die without the special revelation of the gospel perish in their sins. Now, is this true? Do all those without law, without special revelation, sin and perish? Or do some obey, of which Paul doesn't speak here, and not perish? Is there salvation without the gospel? Several considerations will help us answer this question. First, notice, as Murray says, that there is no suggestion that any who are without law attain to eternal life. He says there's no suggestion in verse 12a that any who are without law attain to eternal life. And he's right. Now, incredibly, some have actually used this text to teach the exact opposite. But it does not teach any such thing. Paul never implies, assumes, or says anything about people who don't sin without the law not perishing. He only says that those who sin do perish. Second, notice that there are other texts which teach that all men are sinners. Some of them are in this immediate context, Romans 3:9-20. Plainly teach that all men have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. It is true that there is no clear assertion in Romans 2:12-8 that all who are without law sin and perish. Yet if we combine the other texts which teach that all men sin with our text, the conclusion must be that all those who are without special revelation perish in their sins. Notice the logic. Major premise, all who sin without the law perish. Minor premise, all do sin who are without the law. Conclusion, all who are without the law surely perish. Is that syllogism valid? Of course it's valid. I think it's impeccable in its logical validity. But now, there's one other way of escaping this implication. Notice that there are other clear texts which teach that the only means of escape from the wrath of God revealed against all men is the gospel. People might say, well, they all sin without the law, but some of them repent. Some of them are saved from that sin. Well, fine. But we're talking about people without special revelation. And now, to make the point that all who are not, who are without special revelation actually perish, we have to understand one other premise, and that is that there are other clear texts which teach that the only means of escape from the wrath of God revealed against all men is the gospel. Paul has assumed this in Romans 1:16-17, where he says, I'm not ashamed of the power of God, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. He says it again in verse 17, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. He says it in Romans 3:21, or he implies it, but now apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. And he says it in Romans 10:14 and following. How then shall they call upon him in whom they have not believed? Well, they won't. And how shall they believe in him whom they have not heard? Well, they won't. And how shall they hear without a preacher? Well, they won't. And how shall they preach unless they're sent? You see, the whole line of logic leads us to say that you can't believe unless somebody preaches to you the gospel. And if you can't believe without some gospel, you can't be saved. Therefore, though we take no delight from one standpoint in having to conclude this, we must conclude it from the Bible, that we must conclude that there is no salvation apart from the gospel of Jesus Christ. We must remember that this gospel can only be known by those within the circle of special revelation. All who live, therefore, without special revelation must, therefore, die without special revelation and without salvation. All who live without special revelation must, therefore, die without salvation. Thus, we must say that men have enough light by nature to perish, but they do not have enough to be saved. That's it. That's the natural question to be raised, and all I want to say about it at this point, that's a vexed issue, is that Paul is clearly not thinking of infants or idiots in this passage. And whatever we say about them, we must not dilute what he's saying here. He's clearly talking about people in this passage, I think we can say it very plainly, of whom he assumes a certain mental competence. Right? And the question of infants and idiots is a different question, which I don't think Paul is addressing. I don't think it's a question the Bible addresses directly in any place. Okay? But we can talk about that later. Yeah, you know what I say about that, okay. see, this perishing proceeds according to strict justice. The perishing we're talking about here in verse 12, as we have seen, proceeds according to strict justice. The perishing of the Gentiles is not, therefore, a result of arbitrary sovereignty, in which God is free to do anything he wants without question. That's true, of course, but that's not what we're talking about in verse 12. This is rather clearly an act of God's exact justice. Of course, the idea of perishing without law is contrasted here with the idea of perishing within the circle of the law or special revelation. And this contrast surely teaches that those without law will experience a less severe judgment than those perishing under law. You may note the parallel text, Luke 12, 47 and 48, Matthew 11, 22 and 24, Luke 10, 14. Those are all parallel texts. They teach that there are degrees of punishment in hell, degrees of punishment which are indexed according to the knowledge that people had. I'm not going to discuss those texts right now. But we must not forget that less severe hell is still hell. Those without special revelation have enough revelation not only to deserve the judgment of eternal punishment, but to deserve it in strict justice. They have enough revelation. We must never forget this, and we must never forget it with regard to Romans 1. We must never so dilute general revelation that it becomes impossible to explain how God can send people to hell forever on the basis of it. If we so dilute general revelation that we can't explain the justice of God in sending people to hell forever on a basis, then we have a wrong doctrine in view of general revelation. All I'm saying is that the fact that God sends people to hell on the basis of it speaks very plainly about its length and breadth and depth and certainty and clarity. So this warns us then against so weakening or watering down our view of general revelation that we cannot explain or rationally justify the eternal punishment of those without special revelation. So there's the fact stated. You have any questions about that? Okay, the objection assumed. It is not specifically stated. That's why I say it's assumed. But Paul of Sue assumes an objection to verse 12a. He clearly is answering this unspoken objection in verses 14 and 15. And this unspoken objection is simply this: how can those without the law sin, let alone perish, Paul? They're without the law, how can they sin, let alone perish? I want to say two things about that objection. I want to show you the fact of the objection assumed. The fact of the objection being assumed, as I think, implied in the repeated emphasis on being without the law in verses 12a and verse 14. Paul emphasizes, he hammers that fact. All who sin without the law will perish without the law. When Gentiles who do not have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these not having the law. You see how often he speaks of them? Not having the law. Not having the law. That's the point that's forefront in his mind as he writes these verses. Paul regards, you see, the reason he hammers that statement, is he regards the statement that men sin without law as problematic. Paul regards it as problematic. He said it, but he knows it's a problematic statement. That brings me to the second point, the validity of the objection assumed. Paul regards the objection as valid. He regards it as having an element of truth. What I mean is that he regards it as going out of an important truth of God's Word. The truth is one Paul himself believed and was about to teach in this very letter. This truth is that if one is strictly speaking without the law in every sense, there is no sin, no imputation of sin, and no perishing for sin. Paul himself is about to teach, emphasize it in this very letter, that without the law, strictly speaking, there's no sin, no imputation of sin, and no perishing for sin. Look at Romans 4:15. He says, for the law brings about wrath, but where there is no law, neither is there violation. You can't have violation, and you can't have wrath without law. Sin, you see, implies what the old catechism teaches and what John the Apostle teaches. Sin is the transgression of law. Look at Romans 5:13. For until the law, sin was in the world. Notice what Paul says, though. But sin is not imputed when there is no law. So there is no violation of law, no violation, no imputation of sin, and no wrath where there is no law. Now, Paul himself teaches that in this very letter. And this is why he assumes that people are going to object, because he's not teaching anything that was unique to him. This was, of course, well-understood doctrine. Everyone understood that where there was no law, there was no sin, no violation, no imputation of sin, and no wrath. So, of course, Paul realizes that when he said, those who sin without the law perish without the law, he's raised an enormous objection to what he just said. How can people sin, let alone perish, without law? So with this truth in mind, it's natural to ask, if this is so, how can those without law perish? Now the answer to this difficult question is the burden of verses 14 and 15. It's the whole thrust of verses 14 and 15. It's the whole thrust of verses 14 and 15 is to answer that question. That's why we've got to have it clearly before our minds. The answer to this problem is the whole point of verses 14 and 15. And that brings us to the answer elaborated in verses 14 and 15 in the mass of the material here. Now, in dealing with the elaboration of this answer, we're going to make several points. We're going to deal with its initial assertion in verse 14b, then its rational explanation in verse 15a, and then its external manifestation in verses 14a and 15b. So we're answering the question, the objection, how can men sin, let alone perish, without law, Paul? You yourself teach, without the law there's no sin, no violation, no transgression, no imputation, no wrath. So how can men sin and perish without law? So Paul answers that question in the main subject and predicate of verses 14 and 15. He says in verse 14b, where that subject and predicate are found, these to themselves are law. Or as it's translated, they are, and I think the article ought to be supplied, as I'll argue, they are the law to themselves. They are the law to themselves. These, not having the law, are, as the New American Standard translates, a law to themselves. But, of course, it's simply the anosthetic use of nomos. There's no A there. There's no D there. It's simply law. They are law to themselves. Now, these words, because they include the main verb and noun of the sentence, are the primary assertion of the passage. All else in verses 14 and 15 is grammatically secondary to this primary or initial assertion. When the question is asked, how is it possible, why is it just for Gentiles to sin and perish without the law, Paul's answer is simply that the Gentiles are the law to themselves. Now, this short statement teaches us several things about the Gentiles' confrontation with the law of God. First of all, it speaks to us of the reality of their confrontation with law. In this clause, we come to Paul's simple statement of his answer to the problem raised by the assertion of verse 12a. Gentile sin, their sin is imputed, they perish in their sin, and all this occurs, only may occur, says Paul, because they are, in fact, confronted with the law of God. They're without the law in a certain sense, but in another sense, they're not without the law. Though not confronted with it as a written revelation, they are still confronted with it. They are the law for themselves. And that brings us to the second point, to the means of their confrontation with the law. Not only does Paul say that the Gentiles confront themselves with the law, he also reveals the means or medium through which this confrontation occurs. They are, he says, to or for themselves. It's the dative. They are heautois, yes, debated. They are to, or to be translated for, themselves, the law. The meaning of this is made clear by parallel statements in these verses. The law is theirs, Paul asserts in verse 14a, by nature. Greek word for nature, phusē. Phusē. Okay, the form is phusē. The law is theirs by nature, and according to verse 15a, the work of the law is written in their hearts. Murray says, the law of God confronts them and registers itself in their consciousness by reason of what they natively and constitutionally are. Now, the relevance of this for Christian apologetics and epistemology should be evident. The apostle teaches that men who are without special revelation confront themselves with the law of God. They cannot plead ignorance of God's law. The existence of God's law, and therefore of God, does not need to be proved to them by rational argument. Rational argument and special revelation may clarify, may intensify, may remind them of the demands of God's law, but it's not the origin or basis of their confrontation with God's law. That is innate and natural, so teaches the Apostle Paul. But see, we must deal with something that I've been assuming, the identity of the law. Yes, Stephen?
As far as the law written in their hearts, is that not a standard state of the New Covenant?
That's right. And that phrase there in the notes, I probably should enlarge on, because I'm going to come to argue, Stephen, it's a very perceptive question, that it is not the law itself that's written in their hearts. It is, as Paul makes very plain, the work of the law that's written there, and that's different. Okay? But just think about that for a second. We'll come on to it in a minute. The work of the law written in their hearts. The identity of the law with which they're confronted then. It might seem to be, and in fact it is, evident from verse 12a that it is the law of God which is here mentioned. Because obviously they're not going to be punished for violating somebody else's law. Right? Whoever that might be conceived to be. Sin is the transgression of the law of God. Perishing takes place only at the hands of an angry God. But the problem is, in the clause under consideration, the term law does not have the article T-H-E. It's not ho nomos or tu nomu or whatever it would be in terms of the particular. It's actually the nominative. It's not ho nomos, it's just nomos. Further, in other cases, in verses 14 and 15, the term law also occurs without the article. The question is then, how should these occurrences of the anarthrous nomos, that is to say, law without the article, simply law, be translated? What does Paul mean by law in the statement they are law to themselves? Does he mean law in the abstract? Does he mean the law of God? Does he mean something else? What law is it with which the Gentiles are confronted by themselves, by nature? Well, before exploring these questions, it will be helpful to place the data clearly before us. There are five occurrences of law in verses 14 and 15. In the Greek, three of these occurrences are without article. You have the first occurrence in verse 14. For in Gentiles who do not have law, that is, without the article, do instinctively the things of the law, there the article is present. These not having law, there the article is not present. A law to themselves, there the article is not present again. But in verse 15, in that they shall go to the work of the law, and there the article is present again. All right? You see? The first one doesn't have the article, the second one does, the third and fourth don't, and the one in verse 15 does. Now, already you see that sometimes they translate it with the article, even though it's not there in the original. And that's significant, and it's not wrong either, as we're going to see. So it's clear from this information that there are three reasons why the article should be supplied in the translation of occurrences 1, 3, and 4, and the reference be understood to be the law of God. First, the term law without the article often refers to the law of God specifically and is often translated with the article even though it's not there in the original in the book of Romans. I want you to look at the passage, Romans 2:13. For not the hearers of law are just before God, but the doers of the law will be justified. Now, it's plain that he's talking about the law of God because he's talking about Jews. Look at Romans 2:25. For indeed, circumcision is of value if you practice, notice, law. What law is he talking about? Well, he's talking about the law of God revealed among us. But if you're a transgressor of law, and again, it's plain what law he's talking about, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. Verse 27. And will not he who is physically uncircumcised, if he keeps the law, let me check and see which occurrence is analysis here. If he keeps the law, there the article is present, will he not judge you, who though having the letter of the law and circumcision are a transgressor of law, and it's simply nomu without the article. And then 7:25. Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord, so that on the one hand I myself with my mind am serving the law of God, but on the other with my flesh the law of sin. I think the reference must be then to 7:25. Yes. For Paul says, then therefore I myself on the one hand by my mind serve law of God. No article present. And then 13, 18, and 10. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled law. I'm looking to see if that's the right reference. For the one who loves, the one who loves ton heteron, the other person, the different person, law, no article, has fulfilled. And then verse 10, love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of law, no article. In both cases, it's plain that Paul is thinking explicitly of the law of God. Now, you will notice that both the NIV and the New American Standard translate occurrences 1 and 3 as if the article were present, because they recognize the very principle that I'm speaking to you about. But now, second, when Paul says in verse 14 in the first and third occurrences that Gentiles don't have law, he cannot mean that they're without law of any kind, because they had many laws and many different kinds of law. What they lacked was the written law of God. These occurrences must be therefore translated as a specific reference to the law of God. Third, Paul says twice in occurrences 2 and 5 in this very context that the law with which the Gentiles are confronted of God speaks of the work of the law written in their hearts. In verses 14a and verse 15, he's speaking of the law of God then. Now, the occurrence in verse 15a is particularly important because it refers to the law written on stone in the Old Covenant. The language written on the heart and the writing of law has enormous biblical connections, clear biblical connections. It was the law had been written on stone. Now Paul says the work of the law is written on their heart. The law in the New Covenant will be written in the hearts of believers. Now, whatever else this may or may not show, to me it suggests very plainly the fundamental identity of the law of nature with the law of the Old Covenant and the law of the New Covenant. The work of the law written on the hearts of men by creation, the law written on stone in the Old Covenant, the same law written on the hearts of believers in the New Covenant, these are fundamentally the same. You're not to make a distinction between Jew and Gentile on the basis of what law they have possessed. You make a distinction on the basis of how they possessed it, but not what law they possessed. Both possess the same, fundamentally, law. They simply have it in a different form and with a different clarity. Romans 3:2, which says, what advantage hath the Jew? Great in every respect, first of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. You can also compare 9:3-5. Teach, of course, that having the written law of God was a great advantage. To the Jews. Thus they show that there was a higher degree of clarity and responsibility imparted to men by having the written law. And of course, in that written law, we might add, there were additional elements present, not in the law of nature. Paul isn't commenting on that right now because he's focusing on the moral law. What is that thing you have down there? Is that a spider? I've never seen one quite like that. You can feel free to kill it if you want. I don't want to compete with this fight. So, having the written law gave them a heightened clarity in terms of what the law required and responsibility. Nevertheless, the difference has to do with degree of light, not the identity of the law they possessed. And by way of application, we may say, therefore, that Paul teaches in Romans 2:14-15 the basic unity, continuity, and identity of the law of creation, the law of the Old Covenant, and the law of the New Covenant. No doubt there are elements of distinction and difference between God's commands in these different periods. I'm not denying that. What I'm saying, though, is that Paul assumes a substantial identity. Because he comes on here to speak of what God revealed at Mount Sinai. And he says that it's that very law with which the Gentiles are confronted. Now, how can he say that without assuming that there's at least an equivalence of some kind between creation and Sinai in terms of law? I'm not saying that there's no distinction, but I'm saying that he is assuming a fundamental substructure of identity. And that's what I try to illustrate in the illustration here. Certainly, there are administrative differences. There are other key differences. But in terms of the moral content of the law of God, for which men go to hell for violating, that is fundamentally the same. Now, this rebukes, just a second, Mike. Any and all who speak of the doing away of the Old Covenant law without carefully limiting what they mean. In order to abolish the law of the Old Covenant, one would have to abolish both the law of nature and the law of the New Covenant to abolish the law of the Old Covenant in every sense. And so, I believe this passage is a key one in terms of the whole debate about the law of God. You might get a question. Oh, certainly. Sorry. Now, just a little background. This is a passage that I still am convinced, and I was convinced 15 years ago, when John Zenn started the whole law of grace debate among Reformed Baptists, that fundamentally rebukes the whole dispensational and neo-dispensational tendency to create different laws of God. See, the dispensational assumption is that you have different laws for different people, different laws and different dispensations. The whole tendency of dispensationalism is to emphasize discontinuity in terms of the different dispensations of the Word of God, including discontinuity in terms of the law of God. Well, and that is the tendency of John Jens and what I would call the neo-dispensationalists as well, that while trying to be reformed, have still bought into a substantially dispensational hermeneutic of the law. Now, here Paul makes very plain that his presupposition his foundation is not discontinuity, but continuity. He assumes a fundamental identity of the law of God in all ages. In creation, in Sinai, in the New Covenant, he assumes the law of God is fundamentally, as to its substructure, the same. Now that's a fundamentally different assumption than the dispensationalists and the neo-dispensationalists make. And that's why, when I wrote him a 10-page letter about the whole subject, I expounded this passage for him. Not that it didn't deserve, of course. But this is the passage that's so crucial in that regard. Bob?
I have a debate between Greg Barnes and the Liberty of Paul and John Finder.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because Finder used this passage to try to say that we're no longer under the law of Sinai because we make the view about the distinction. And he says, now I'm a new covenant, we're under this. I forget if he calls it natural law. And you make the distinction.
Well, this whole passage is embedded in a context where the term law in verses 17 to 29 plainly is referring to what was given to the Jews in Mount Sinai. And he attributes the knowledge of that law to the Gentiles. That's incredible. Absolutely insane, exegetically, as far as I'm concerned. We cannot teach on the basis of this passage the exact identity of the New Covenant and the Old Covenant creation. There are, of course, differences, but what Paul? What you can't interpret the passage without assuming is that there's a fundamental identity, a basic, substantial sameness about these things. Okay. Now, the fourth thing we come to then is that we're now prepared, having looked at these different considerations, to discuss the translation of occurrence, number four. How should the word law in the clause under discussion, these to themselves are law, be translated? Well, since in the first place all of the other occurrences in verses 14 and 15 have specific references to the law of God, and since in the second place, twice in these verses, Paul specifically ascribes confrontation with the law of God to Gentiles, we ought to translate the clause under discussion, they are the law to themselves. They are to themselves not some law or other, but the law of God. The point of importance in all this is that it shows the extent of the knowledge of the law which Gentiles possess. It is not a mere vestige or remnant of knowledge of the moral law, which Paul says that the Gentiles have, but the knowledge of the law of God itself. So it's important to emphasize that. People are talking about remnants and vestiges. But that's apologetical eutychianism. The remnants and vestiges are only remnants and vestiges because that's what they admit in the intellectual system. You all right now? Sorry about that. But you see, vestige and remnant doesn't do justice to what Paul is saying here. They're not confronted with just some, you know, scattered rags out of the garment of the law of God. Paul says they're confronted with the law of God in its substantial wholeness, its fundamental unity, and in some of its detailed commands, as the context makes very plain. So, vestiges and remnants are all very well, but you don't justify men going to hell by sinning against vestiges and remnants of the law of God. You justify them going to hell because they had and sinned against the law of God. All right, any questions there about the initial assertion of the thing? So now we come to its rational explanation, verse 15a. In that, Paul says, they show the work of the law written in their hearts. Now, in this clause, Paul reveals why he is sure that the Gentiles are the law to themselves. This is its rational explanation. And I say that it's the explanation because of the subject of the clause translated in that they in the New American Standard. the subject of the clause. The pronoun used here has a causal force. The pronoun is, I'm going to actually tell you what it was, didn't I? The pronoun, hoitinus. Hoitinus. Has a causal force. Look at 125. See that? For they exchanged. Same causal force. There's no gar there. It's simply hoitinus, metallexon. Metallexon. So the verb, this pronoun used here, frequently has a causal force. Thus the clause should be translated, because such Gentiles show. This clause, therefore, states the reason or support for Paul's statement that the Gentiles are the law for themselves. They are the law to themselves, seeing or because they manifest the work of the law written in their hearts. And you'll notice how verse 15a, because such ones show the work of the law written in their hearts, is tied to verse 14a's assertion, they do the things of the law, through the assertion of verse 14b. That's the subject of the clause. Now notice the predicate of the clause in the verb show, which is endek nuntai. Why I didn't put right in it. The verb designates the external manifestation of an internal reality. They show the work of the law written in their heart. The internal reality is the work of the law written in their heart. They show this internal principle by what was stated in verse 14a and what's restated in verse 15b. They have this work of the law written in their heart. How do they show that? They show it by doing the things of the law, and they show it by their conscience bearing witness, either defending or else, or either accusing or else even defending them. But then there's the next object, which is the phrase, the work of the law written in their hearts. And here we come to your question, Stephen. I want you to note that Paul does not say that the law is written in their hearts. It is the work of the law which is written. In the Greek, the word written agrees in case with work, not law. See if I can make that point. Oh, yeah, I think we can do it. It's to ergon, the work, to nomu, propton, the work of the law written. Now, notice how grapton ends. It ends with what we might call O-N. Let's see, in the omicron nu. To ergon, to nomu, grapton. Ergon, or grapton, I should say, modifies ergon, not nomu. Alright? So, work and written agree in case. So he does not say it's the law that's written. He's saying the work of the law is written. Thus, Paul very carefully words his statement so as to avoid saying that Gentiles have the law written on their hearts. Why does he avoid saying that? Well, this would have meant that they had a part in the blessings of the new covenant. Jeremiah 31:33, and implied that Gentiles without special revelation are saved, which is exactly the opposite of what Paul was saying. This Paul could not say, and he would not even imply. While Gentiles are confronted with God and his law, they do not know the gospel and cannot be saved. The law is not written savingly in their hearts. But now we come to the crucial question. What then does Paul mean by the work of the law? And there are two choices. There is the majority view. The best example of one who favors this view is John Murray. According to this view, the work of the law is simply the work which the law requires of us. Key phrase. The work which the law requires of us. Mary says things required and stipulated by the law are written upon the heart. But then there is the minority view. Examples of those who take this view are Beza and Holbein. This view was suggested to me by Pastor Nichols. He asserts the law's work is the work the law does. Not the work the law requires, but the work the law does. But you understand what I'm saying. So the question is the work the law requires? Is the work the law requires? Or is the work of the law the work which the law does? What does it mean, work of the law? Now, having for several years held and taught the majority view, I now reject it in favor of the minority view. And this view appears clearly better to me for the following reason. So I'm saying that I think that the work of the law is the law's work, or the work that the law does. And Paul says the work of the law, he's saying that the Gentiles have what the law does written in their hearts. Now, putting it like that, you see that there's a real question here, and I want to give you my reasons for having adopted this view. First, the precise expression used here by Paul, work of the law, is found nowhere else in the Bible. Now, there are lots of similar phrases. The works of the law, Romans 3:20, and the righteousness of the law, Romans 8:4, since they are not strict parallels, cannot be certain evidence in favor of meaning the work required by the law. Certainly the works of the law mean something like the works required by the law, and the righteousness of the law means something like the righteousness required by the law, but those are not strictly parallel, and I do not believe there can be certain evidence in favor of that interpretation. Second, the general context of Romans 2:1 through 16 favors the minority view. Paul is thinking of the moralistic and hypocritical tendency of fallen mankind to pass judgment on others. I mean, you see that in Romans 2:1. Therefore, you are without excuse, every man of you who passes judgment, for in that you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things. We know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. And do you suppose that this, O man, when you pass judgment upon those who practice such things and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? What are you talking about? They're doing the same things the law did. The law passes judgment. That's what they were doing. But then they did the same things themselves. Clearly, they were self-condemned. Paul is thinking of the moralistic and hypocritical tendency of fallen mankind to pass judgment on others, yet practice the very things for which they condemn others. This is the thought of both the preceding and succeeding context. Notice as well as 2:1-3, also verses 17-23, where Paul goes on to elaborate that same kind of moralistic and hypocritical tendency among the Jews. In such a context, it is natural to view Paul in verses 14 and 15 as using the same thing as proof of the Gentiles' moral guilt before God. They show the work of the law, that is to say, the work which the law itself performs, by their passing judgment on and accusing others. Third, the phrase, the things of the law, used in verse 14, they do the things of the law, is clearly parallel to the phrase, the work of the law. Now, think clearly. The things of the law, however, must be a reference not to the things required by the law, but to the things done by the law. Why do I say that? Well, this is the case because in doing the things of the law, they are the law to themselves. Notice the connection. They do the things of the law, Paul says, for when Gentiles who don't have the law do instinctively the things of the law, these are the law to themselves. So it's when Gentiles do the things of the law that they're the law to themselves. That connection is important. This cannot mean that in doing the things the law requires, they are the law. It can't mean that. If this were the case, it would follow that by obeying the law, we become the law. You follow me? Paul is arguing here. He's saying they do the things of the law, therefore they are the law to themselves. But we don't become the law by obeying the law. That's not what Paul is saying, therefore. We don't become the law because we obey it. Paul is saying they are the law because they do the things of the law. What does he mean? He means they're doing the things the law does, and therefore they are the law to themselves. They pass judgment, they accuse, they defend, they reveal standards of right and wrong. That's what the law does. That's why they're the law to themselves. Paul cannot be saying that they become the law because they do what the law requires. That's nonsense and makes nonsense of Paul's assertion. If, however, the phrase means that in doing the things performed by the law, defining right and wrong, commanding, condemning, they are the law, this makes much better sense. The phrase, the things of the law, then means the things the law does. Thus, by implication, the phrase, the work of the law, must be the work the law does. Fourth, the phrase, the work of the law written in their hearts, would logically demand the idea that the promise of the new covenant, follow me, has been fulfilled in the case of these Gentiles. If it means that what the law requires is written in their hearts. Now, if the work of the law means what the law requires, then Paul is saying, what the law requires is written in their hearts. But that would be no different than saying the law was written in their hearts, which Paul is, of course, eager not to say. For the promise of the new covenant is that God would write his law, that is to say, what it requires, its precepts on our hearts. Similarly, the phrase, for when Gentiles do instinctively the things of the law, would directly imply or assert that these Gentiles are the doers of the law, and so, according to verse 13, would be justified. Now, it's true, of course, that Murray and others seek to avoid this evil and false conclusion by making a distinction between the law written on the heart and the work required by the law written on the heart. Murray also distinguishes between doing the things of the law externally and occasionally and doing the law really and perpetually. As Pastor Nichols says, however, this boils down to a distinction without a difference. Having explained these phrases, then, it remains to be asked, what is Paul thinking of when he speaks of the things and the work which the law does? When he speaks of them, the things the law does and the works the law does, or the work which the law does, what is he talking about? Well, the immediate context clearly suggests the functions of the law which Paul has in mind. First of all, Paul is thinking of the condemning function of the law. He is thinking of how the Gentiles pass judgment upon and accuse one another, 2:1 through 3 in verse 15. Secondly, he is thinking how the law enables men to know God's will and approve the essential things and instructs them as to right and wrong, with 2:17-19. But if you bear the name Jew and rely upon the law and boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are essential, being instructed out of the law. So you see, he's talking about how the law reveals right and wrong, gives us a divine standard for our lives, imposes that standard upon us. The law provides men with a divine standard of right and wrong. Now, it's helpful in forming a more clear idea of this to examine the larger context of this issue in Romans. What does the book of Romans at large teach about the function of the law? By the way, when you ask that question, you realize that the function of the law is one of the major themes of the book of Romans, isn't it? The function of the law. And when we ask this question, we are reminded of this, and we see in Romans 3:20 that the law is given for the knowledge of sin. Through the law comes the knowledge of sin. In 4:15, we're told that the law brings about wrath. In 5:20, that the law came in that the transgression might increase. And in 7:5-13, we're told that the law came to make sin exceedingly sinful and to kill us in our self-righteousness. When it comes alive in our consciences. We're told that the law is holy and commandments. sin is holy and righteous and good. So, the whole book of Romans enlarges on the fact that the law is to give us a knowledge of sin. That's the whole function of the law. That's the whole work of the law. The importance of this is that what the law did for the Jews, the Gentiles did for themselves. Their own hearts, their natures, their persons, enable them to know parts of their ethical duty and that light to expose sin in others and pass judgment upon it. And when we remember that Paul is answering the objection that the Gentiles cannot sin without law, then we must add that the function of giving men a divine standard of right and wrong is primarily in view here. Paul's concern is, of course, how can they sin? Whereas we don't sin against the condemning function of the law so much as we sin against it in its instructing function. All right? So that's the primary thing in view here. Practically, both John Murray and this view come to the same thing, only you get to it in a little bit more convoluted way with this interpretation, I suppose. Any questions? All right, let's come then to verses 14a and 15b. That's what I've called the external manifestation. The external manifestation. We've seen the initial assertion, the rational explanation, in that they show the work of the law written in the hearts. Now we come to the external manifestation, and that has to do with two legs. There are two legs of this, verse 14a and verse 15b. The work of the law is written in the heart of men, and as such is in itself invisible to anyone but God. All right? You can't see it. This work, however, is manifested visibly and continually by fallen men. In our passage, this manifestation is first stated in verse 14a, they do the things of the law, and then is restated in verse 15b, their conscience bearing witness and their thoughts alternately accusing or else defending them. Now, in our passage, this manifestation is then stated in verse 14a and 15b. This manifestation is not to be equated with the work of the law written in the heart. The doing of the things of the law and the conscience bearing witness, the thoughts accusing or even defending them, all manifest and presuppose the work of the law written in the heart. But because they are manifestations of it, for that very reason, they are not to be made the same as it. Manifestation and what it reveals are two different things. The work of the law is God's creation. The doing of the things of the law is their sometimes perverted and depraved manifestation of the work of the law. Even in their acts of in the acts of their conscience, they are truth suppressors, and that's thus, even their conscience may be defiled, Titus 1:15. So we've got to make a distinction again between what's given in God's act of creation, the work of the law is written in their hearts, and what's manifested and as manifested is revelatory not only of what God says, but of their own depravity. All right? Conscience and the doing of the things of the law, those things are distorted by human depravity. They still manifest the reality. The same sense that false philosophy and false religion manifest the sensus deitatis. But they're not the thing themselves. The work of the law and the conscience are not the same thing. The conscience may be defiled. The work of the law can only be suppressed. Now, this is stated then in verse 14a. The first statement of the manifestation of the work of the law written in the hearts of the Gentiles is that they instinctively and repeatedly do what the law of God does. Since the meaning of this phrase has already been mostly explained, only two remarks are necessary here. First, we note that these actions are instinctive. They are done, as Paul says, by nature, that is, via the light available to men apart from special revelation. The emphasis on the person, natures, and hearts of the Gentiles has been noticed already. It speaks of the indestructible knowledge of the law which men possess without special revelation. But these actions are not only instinctive, these actions are repetitive. When, the Greek word is hoton, is here employed with the present subjective of the verb do, poieo. The Greek lexicon, Balart and Gingrich, says of this usage that it means whenever, as often as, every time. So every time they do the things of the law, Paul is really saying. Whenever, and they do it often, Gentiles do the things of the law. Paul is thus not thinking of an isolated instance of doing the things of the law. He's thinking of repeated occasions in which Gentiles do what the law does. They're constantly passing judgment on other men. They're constantly instructing themselves as to right and wrong. They do that all the time. It's repetitive, you see. Well, there's the statement of it, but then there's the restatement of it in verse 15b. The general connection of verse 15b to the previous statements is clear. The conscience of the Gentiles shows or visibly manifests the work of the law written in their hearts. Lenski remarks that the grammatical construction of the phrase accusing or even defending them implies that accusation is more common. In other words, he is probably saying that the Gentiles' conscience more often accuses them than defends them, although sometimes it may even defend them or others. Normally, conscience is in fallen men accusing other men or themselves of sin, but sometimes it may even be engaged in defending other men or themselves. Accusation is more common. This is what we would expect in light of the reference of this phrase to Romans 2:1-3. John Murray properly concludes from this clause, accusation and accusation, one of his invented words, accusation and excusation, whether of ourselves or others, are activities which evidence moral consciousness and therefore point to our indestructible moral nature, the only rationale of which is the work of the law of God in the heart. So he says, the only way to explain conscience as it functions in fallen human beings is on the basis of the presupposition that God's creating them with the work of his law in their hearts. All right, three conclusions then, and then we'll be done. First, this passage confirms the teaching of Romans 1 as to the reality of the knowledge of the living God and those without special revelation. The work of the law is written in their hearts, and thus they confront themselves with both the precepts and penalties of the law of God. Thus they know the one true and living God because they know him specifically in his position as lawgiver. They know God, they know his justice, they know him as lawgiver. Further, they know this God by nature and by means of their own hearts, and thus this knowledge must be absolutely universal among those who possess human nature. Universal, therefore, because it's natural. But second, this passage brings to completion the teaching of Romans 1 concerning the source of their knowledge of God. In Romans 1, 19 and 20, the source of this knowledge is external creation. In Romans 2, 15, the thought is added that man's own nature and heart reveal the knowledge of God. Thus, Kuyper is right when he says that man has a twofold office in revelation. He is both a source of and the recipient of revelation. Kuyper says, if the cosmos is the theater of revelation, in this theater man is both actor and spectator. Third, this passage expands the teaching of Romans 1 as to the extent of their knowledge of God by nature and creation. Not only do men know God, but they have an extensive knowledge of the moral requirements of the law. This might be deduced from the fact that men, according to Romans 1:18-20, know the character of the living God. Since the moral law of God is simply the transcript or account of his character as it comes to bear upon or controls the regulation of human conduct, to know God truly is to know something of his law. All of this, however, is confirmed by Romans 2:12a, 14, and 15. And it's also confirmed by Romans 1:32, the statement of Paul which leads into Romans 2:1-16. This verse assumes a thorough knowledge of lengthy portions of the actual content of the commands of God's moral law, referring to the extensive list of sins in verses 29 to 31. Verse 32 asserts of men by nature that they know that those who practice such things are worthy of death. But notice what verses 29 to 31 have been talking about. Being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossip, slanders, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful, and although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death. What's he saying? Verse 32 asserts that they know that such things are evil. But notice how much Paul said here. This knowledge, therefore, that they possess of God's law includes revelation as to violations of the 10th commandment, because it includes greed and envy. Violations of the 9th commandment, because it includes deceit, gossips, and slanders. It includes violations of the 8th commandment, because it includes greed and envy. Again, thou shalt not steal. It includes violations of the 6th commandment, malice, murder, strife, unmerciful. It includes violations of the 5th commandment, disobedience to parents, and includes general violations of the first 4 commandments, disobedience of God, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. And of course, I don't think I'll have any problem convincing you that Paul includes all those things, and no doubt includes violations of the 7th commandment as well. So Scripture then testifies to the idea that along with the knowledge of God and rooted in this a many-sided revelation of the moral requirements of God's law planted in man by creation. All right.